From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's USDA Report Day, the 30th day of June. The acreage figures and grain stocks numbers were released at 11 o'clock this morning. We'll take a look at those numbers with Mike Zuzlo, Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll also take them up during Commodity Week, the second half hour, if you can stay with us this afternoon, with Sherman Newland. He's at Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. Greg Ginder from Chesterfield, Missouri, and F.C. Stone will be with us. And our special guests on the program, Alan Brugler, Brugler Marketing and Management out of Omaha, Nebraska. Stay with us right here on this Friday edition of the agricultural programming that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Let's take a look at the numbers as they arrived from the United States Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C., and explore what they meant with Mike Zuzlo. He's a Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Atchison, Kansas. What a morning it was, Mike, once USDA released the numbers today.
You know, it's a week that I think we can look back on into the July 4th holiday, even though we trade a little bit on Monday, Todd, and welcome a nice change after the last couple, 3 years of price action, that's for sure. So USDA did not disappoint. They came in with still record high soybean acres, but they came in low enough and on the low end of trade estimates and just maybe even a hair under trade estimates that it really gave the beans a reason to not penetrate the 905 low. And it gave the beans a reason to keep a weather premium in place. And I think that in turn helped give a reason to the whole grain market to find short covering and very supportive trade in the post-report environment. Record low wheat acres obviously helping a lot there as well and giving us 45.65 million planted acres of wheat. Spring wheat acres actually were below the lowest trade guess on the Reuters estimates. So between the weather and this acreage report and wheat, you still can't, in my view, put a top or a price limit on the spring wheat price action. And I think the oats showed that, especially as we went into the close today, jumping about 40 cents a bushel at one point or 35 cents a bushel at one point, closing up about 15% just on today's trade. So Canada and the Northern Plains continue to support. USDA didn't do anything to hurt us.
So when we go back and summarize what happened from the acreage numbers, as you mentioned, the all wheat number was at 45,657, or rather 45,657,000 acres. That was down 402 million from the March intentions. The soybean number was up about 31 million, but roughly the same at 89.5 million acres. Corn jumped 890 million acres to 90.8. That's up from 89.996. So there was a big jump in the corn market. So if it was not the acreage that pushed things around the day, and we can come back to that acreage figure for corn, was it the grain stocks number that pushed?
Well, possibly. I think the way I looked at this market going into the report was the trade was buying the beans and selling the corn, assuming that we would get a more friendly report from the grain stocks and the soybeans. And that didn't disappoint. The trade played it very, very wisely. And you probably took about 15 million bushels off the old crop beans thanks to today's grain stocks report, and maybe a little bit more than that thanks to the acreage report. So you're probably closer to a 480 new crop carryover in the soybeans because of those two reports, whereas the corn probably closer to a 2.3 and maybe a little over billion bushel carryover for new crop because you didn't get a reduction in the grain stocks. In fact, you stayed elevated. And so the USDA feels, I guess, very strong about their export. Year-to-date commitments will be dropping off very quickly this last 10 weeks of the marketing year. This is probably one of the biggest features to watch. I think to go back around to why we didn't break on any of these numbers was because we did have the wheat underneath us. And we had the wheat underneath us, not just because of the spring wheat crop weather and little hope for anything but declining crop conditions. But I think the crude oil and the dollar, and I put a lot of this at the crude oil's feet. I feel like we had to have a bottom in the crude oil before we could trade a positive report by USDA. And so it was a good week fundamentally in the outside markets as well, with the dollar taking all of its President Trump election premium out of the market by the time we got to today's numbers.
All right. So when I look at these numbers, I ask myself, what changed today at 11 o'clock? And what I really see is we have, you know, 15 or 20 million bushels less maybe carryover in soybeans. We have 400 million less acres of wheat, correct? And we have nearly 900 million more acres of corn. And when I add it all up, I'm surprised that the market really bounced as much as it did. And I can only guess that I have to lay that at the wheat, at the feet of wheat, and as you said, maybe crude oil as well.
And I think you bring up a huge point. And I tried to give this in a late day audio to my clients because I had bought and recommended buying some cheap puts, some 10, 15 cent puts before the report in the beans, with the idea that if anything was going to sink our rally, it was going to be the soybeans on this report, because it's the new leader to the downside based upon my analysis, exactly because of what you're talking about as far as still a very large carryover here domestically, even though the crop's not made and it's a very short crop and the conditions went down a point this week. But you also have that South American crop. You also have these issues with China. And so my mindset was, if I'm wrong, quote unquote, to buy the puts and beans, and I'll make it up not only in the beans, but I'll make it up in the corn. And I think that's an accurate portrayal of this market, mainly because of the fact that you still want to be a seller. I think this is where the medium-term analysis continues to show fundamentally we have an adequate supply. And even after today's, you know, very nice rally, not taking anything away from it, beans still haven't broken out of their trading range. You still have the 200-month moving average and lead month beans at 945 that needs to be violated. You still have the lead month meal trend resistance right around 310. Until those two things happen, even technically, you can't say the beans have the ability to change trend. And so what I'm trying to portray to clients is we got a real beneficial report, beneficial outside markets, beneficial wheat weather, but it's still a market to hedge for, and it's still a profitable, it's still a market where you can get profit or try for profit. So I feel like the $600 an acre profit in beans, or $800 revenue in corn, $600 in beans, is a real crucial, two crucial numbers to stay in the forefront of your mind as you go through this crop year.
So have you talked to many producers across the Midwest? And I know you have. To get an idea, the other thing I want to explore with you this afternoon is what the condition of the corn crop and the bean crop really is and how variable it might be, and if that variability is enough to impact yields dramatically by the time we get to the fall.
It is very variable. It's probably as variable as 2009 and 2010. And it's interesting because USDA's principal number of planted crops in this report today was 318.2 million. That was down 1.1 million from last year. It's actually the smallest since we went back to 2011. But yes, when I drove to Belleville for a meeting with the Farm Bureau there on Monday, I saw corn tasseling. I saw corn that was knee high. I saw beans that had just sprouted out of the ground. And so Indiana and Illinois clients in certain sections are still suffering from drowned out spots there. I got a call from Eastern Indiana just before we went on the air, and a client said, I'm down by Muncie. We have issues with drowned out corn and beans again, and it looks like the crops are both dying. So this time of year, you'd think the corn would be well above the size or height it needs to be to withstand a heavy rain, but it's not. So it does take the top end off the yield, and I think this is where it goes back to what kind of revenue you're going after. And this is where you have to adjust your yield as you go along. But the next 2 to 3 weeks, I think, be careful about cash sales. But that doesn't mean you throw the baby out with the bathwater and go long this market and try and make up for some lost sales from either 15 or 16.
Yesterday, and I was traveling up to Chicago for an event with the CME group, so I didn't have a program yesterday. We didn't talk about the hogs and pigs numbers. Looks like they must have been friendly to that marketplace.
Very much so, in a respect that you didn't get anything to stop the funds from buying the hogs. And Todd, I think probably the best chart to be watching in the livestock, whether you're a hog client or a rancher with cattle. The hog cattle spread, or the cattle hog spread, is right around $28. That's a new low. That's a new 2.5-3 year low that cattle are only about $28 premium to the hogs. What that tells me or suggests to me is that as you drop below $25 a head premium in the cattle. And as your packer break-evens go above $300 a head in cattle, you're probably relying upon the cattle more to be able to make new highs in the hogs. So with those back-end October hogs getting up above $70 and getting into the low 70s, I think we've got to be really, really cautious about not locking in some fall hogs in the not-too-distant future unless the cattle come back around and really start to roll.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Have a great weekend, a good July 4th. Mike Zuzulo, of course, is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, we'll start overseas. U.S. officials and beef industry representatives have celebrated the return of American beef to China. USDA's Stephanie Ho has more.
U.S. beef is back in China.
Restoring U.S. beef access to China has been a top priority for the U.S. beef producers for many years.
Craig Uden, president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, was on hand at a prime rib carving event in Beijing, along with Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue.
We want to respect your market and assure you that these products coming in are safe, wholesome, and very delicious.
He added that he was encouraged by his meetings with Chinese officials.
There's an opportunity for agriculture to lead the way in the future relationship of commerce between our two wonderful countries.
The theme of trade was echoed by U.S. Ambassador to China, Terry Branstad.
Beef is a good and a great beginning for this process.
China's imports of beef rose from $275 million in 2012 to $2.5 billion in 2016. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, let's stay in Washington, D.C. The Securing Our Agriculture and Food Act recently passed through both the Senate and the House of Representatives in a bipartisan fashion. It now awaits final approval from President Trump. A BovineVetOnline.com article says the language in the bill helps to clarify what the role of the Department of Homeland Security is as it works with other federal agencies to prevent agricultural terrorism. The DHS Assistant Secretary for Health Affairs is the official charged with collaborating between agencies to keep America's food supply safe. However, the act does not supersede the authority of the Secretary of Agriculture when it comes to food and agriculture. Iowa Republican Representative David Young first authored the bill in 2016 and again this year. It was largely in response to the avian influenza outbreak of 2015. That was the costliest animal outbreak in U.S. history. An analysis from the Congressional Budget Office says the bill would cost less than $500,000 a year to implement and would not affect direct spending or revenues. Well, let's switch to trade now. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative wrapped up public comment hearings this week on the upcoming North America Free Trade Agreement negotiations. Ag groups representing American farmers and ranchers had a chance to weigh in on what they'd like to see in the talks. A group of senators also weighed in on what they'd like to see emphasized in the discussions, and their number one topic to address is agricultural exports. 17 lawmakers wrote a letter to U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer expressing appreciation for the administration's careful approach to strengthening the NAFTA agreement while ensuring that no changes are made that could be harmful to agriculture. The senators that signed the letter represent states that have significant agricultural exports to Canada and Mexico. Those countries are two of the top five destinations for American agricultural goods. On that note, we'll go overseas where European Union and Japanese officials both say they're close to signing what would be a major free trade deal, which could potentially jumpstart other free trade deals. A European Union negotiator says a deal between the two would let the rest of the world know that the two of the largest economies are resisting protectionism in favor of openness and investment. The website usnews.com says the EU and Japan make up more than a quarter of the world's economy. They traded more than $140 billion worth of goods last year, and a new agreement would boost that number considerably higher. The head of the Japan Foreign Exchange Research Department at JP Morgan says a deal between the EU and Japan would make it much harder for American agriculture to compete in those markets. And finally today, we'll come back here to the Midwest, where an Iowa farmer and son have been sentenced to jail as corporate officials who have legally been found responsible for a foodborne disease outbreak. A CattleNetwork.com article says Austin DeCoster and his son Peter were sentenced to 3 months in jail for selling adulterated food as corporate officers. The U.S. District Judge hearing the case noted prison time was a necessary thing to deter corporate officials from selling unsafe food. Both men appealed their sentences, but the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the case. The DeCosters pled guilty to shipping eggs with false processing and expiration dates on the packages. They also pled guilty to bribing a U.S. inspector to approve the poor quality eggs for sale to the public. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. It's a Friday afternoon, USDA Report Day. We'll have more on those reports during Commodity Week. It's a live program coming up in the second half hour, if you can stay along with us. Greg Ginder from FC Stone, Sherman Newland from Risk Management Commodities, and Alan Brugler, Brugler Marketing and Management, will join us to talk about the numbers, the impact in Chicago, and the expectations going forward through the July 4th week. Weekend Commodity Week, our weekly look at what's happening in the world of agriculture. If you can't stay with us, some of these radio stations, of course, will run the program again over the weekend, or you can always listen to it online at willag.org. I'll have it up within, about an hour from this time frame. That's at willag.org. Speaking of which, if you prefer to use it as a podcast, you can find us in Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and my favorite way to listen to the program, using the NPR One app. You know, popular USDA conservation programs are underfunded and oversubscribed. At least that's what one USDA witness told the Senate Agriculture Committee yesterday during its latest Farm Bill hearing. It's no secret that USDA conservation and working lands programs are pretty popular. Things like EQIP, CRP, CSP, regional conservation and partnerships, and others that help producers' bottom line, as well as the environment. And those have all, and most of them have long waiting lists. But the extent by which demand exceeds contracts is eye-opening, especially after the 2014 Farm Bill cut some $6 billion from the programs over a 10-year period, says the Deputy Chief of Programs for the National Resources Conservation Service, Jimmy Bramblett.
These programs are greatly oversubscribed. Just for example, with the Conservation Stewardship Program, I mentioned earlier in my opening statements that we saw a 30% increase in applications this year. What that means is we'll have almost 19,000 applications for the Conservation Stewardship Program, and we anticipate we're only going to be able to fulfill about 6,500 of those.
And that's just one example, according to Bramblett, pointing to the ranking ag member's home state of Michigan.
For the Environmental Quality Incentives Program in your home state, there's 1,745 applications last year, which were only able to fill 946 of them. So a 2-to-1 backlog there.
And as much as 5 or 6-to-1 in other states. The Regional Conservation Partnership Program for Sediment and Nutrient Management has $200 million this year. Producer proposals seek some $640 million. And Bramblett told ag senators that easement programs face a 6.5-year-to-1 backlog. He says the demand for conservation dollars speaks to the profitability the programs add to farming. The top Democrat on the ag committee, Debbie Stabenow, agrees.
When we talk about risk management, in the last Farm Bill, we strengthened risk management tools, crop insurance being one. But conservation is also a risk management tool for farmers and ranchers today.
The Senate will continue to hold Farm Bill hearings throughout this year. Now let's turn our attention to the weather forecast. Eric Snodgrass is from Agrible. Thanks for being with us, Eric, this afternoon. Can you tell me how you view the recent rains and what's coming up?
You know, Todd, over the last few days, I got the opportunity to drive a pretty big section of Illinois. I was able to drive pretty far south and also run the entire length of Interstate 39 running north. And I'll tell you what, the one thing that stands out to me this year about Illinois is not necessarily the coloration and the health of the overall crop. It's the unevenness of it. I saw fields that were already going to tassel in parts of southern Illinois and central Illinois. And then as I drove north on I-39, I saw a whole lot of fields where the corn looked like it had just emerged. I mean, it was incredible to see such an enormous variety of the stage of the crop in Illinois. I think that's got us set up this year to be quite vulnerable to a lot of different weather stresses in July. Well, let's talk about what happened most recently. We had a huge section of the Corn Belt get quite a bit of precipitation, better than a half inch of rain. Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Northern Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, you know, all saw better than an inch too. And Iowa, the state that's probably doing the best in the Corn Belt so far, a lot of regions in there got better than an inch and an inch and a half. And that's just setting up Iowa to continue to do quite well this year. But there's concern as we head into July that fields in the southern half of Illinois, which didn't get this rain, may be under some stress looking forward. So that's why my forecast for the rest of the day is quite important. But before we get to that, I want to tell you, I was on the phone just a couple of days ago with some farmers in Montana, and we know that drought has really spread in eastern Montana and most of the parts of North and South Dakota. And I was talking with those folks about their wheat yields, and I'll tell you something. One guy told me that he expects his wheat yields to be zero. That's his spring wheat yields. In fact, if you look out there, it just looks like a lawn. You know, he has just 6-inch tall wheat. It looks pretty bad. So we have some pretty serious drought in parts of the northern and far northwestern Corn Belt. And that part of the Corn Belt, when it establishes drought in late spring and early summer, it rarely, if ever, recovers. So let's get back to that short-term forecast. Right now, I'm watching for this afternoon, this Friday afternoon, for the potential for more storms to fire along a boundary that's kind of stretched from northern Indiana through Arkansas. And this could bring the needed precipitation we need here in kind of east central Illinois to help out with our recent deficit in rain. Over the weekend, that big trough that's kind of sitting over the Great Lakes is finally going to move off to the east, and a large ridge builds out west. Now, the issue with that is we're going to see 90-degree plus temperatures stretching all the way from Texas to Montana and North Dakota. And because of that kind of flow pattern we get with the ridge, it's going to shut down the rain in those states, especially in Montana and North Dakota, which are already dry. Now, we in the eastern part of the Corn Belt are going to experience what we call northwest flow, which means that we're not going to see the extreme heat. You know, I do expect mid to upper 80s next week, and there is another chance for storms on the 4th of July. But if the models are correct in keeping that ridge to the west of the eastern part of the Corn Belt, that's actually a pretty favorable setup. Now, given that as our short-term forecast, we will be watching the position of that ridge throughout the entire month of July. The good news right now is I'm not seeing anything that's going to block the whole pattern up for more than about 8 to 10 days, which is a good sign. The atmosphere is going to continue to flow. But some places globally that are not getting that kind of good luck with the kind of the consistent flow pattern of the jet stream, let's take a look at Europe right now. You know, the last half of June saw drought worsening in Ukraine, and also parts of Germany and France have been abnormally dry going into this crucial month of July. And the forecast for those countries is to stay warmer than average and drier than average through the month of July. Elsewhere, if you kind of look to northern and northeastern China and far eastern Mongolia, you know, this region has really been struggling with drought over the last 3 months. And so I'm just bringing this up to kind of show kind of the global pressures that we're seeing on grains right now, which is the first time in a few years I've been able to say there's been some global pressure on grain supply. So there's quite a bit to be talking about. And again, watch for the month of July, the position of that ridge out west. If it migrates east at all, that could potentially impact corn yields here in the state of Illinois.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He's with Agrible, joins us here on the Closing Market Report for this 30th day of June.